Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining our call today on the Garland nomination. My name is Kara Stein, and I'm the Vice President of Policy Development and Programming at ACS. And it's been nearly 2 weeks since President Obama nominated D.C. Circuit Chief Judge Merrick Garland to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court left by Justice Scalia's unexpected passing. During this time, ACS has been actively engaging the legal community in this important conversation, and just by way of example, 33 of our constitutional law scholars signed onto a letter urging the President and the Senate to fulfill their constitutional duties and move the process forward. We've hosted several calls like this one with leading experts, and scholars, practitioners, judges, and students in the ACS network have been writing and calling and tweeting and hosting events on this important topic across the country, and we really encourage you all to engage the debate. Meanwhile, the Senate leadership has been doubling down on its calls to halt the confirmation process entirely, but a small number of senators are now agreeing to hold courtesy visits with Chief Judge Garland. We hope that number increases. Today, we're very pleased to be joined by two experts who know the Supreme Court confirmation process quite well, although they worked for presidents from opposite sides of the political aisle, Professor Richard Painter and Michael Gottlieb. Professor Painter was associate counsel to President George W. Bush, serving as his chief ethics lawyer. In that capacity, he assisted with the nomination and confirmation of Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court. After receiving his JD from Yale, he clerked for Judge John Noonan of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Professor Painter is currently the S. Walter Ritchie Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. Michael Gottlieb was special assistant to President Barack Obama during the nomination and confirmation of Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Michael then served as deputy director of Joint Task Force 435 in Kabul, Afghanistan. Upon completion of his time there, he served as associate White House counsel from 2011 to 2013. After receiving his JD from Harvard, Michael clerked for Judge Stephen Reinhardt of the U.S. Court of Appeals, also the Ninth Circuit, and Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. Michael is currently a partner at Boies Schiller and Flexner, and we thank them both for taking their time today to share their insights. We'll be happy to take questions from our callers after we hear from our speakers, so remember to jot them down as you listen. And we're gonna start with Richard. Richard, you had an op-ed in the New York Times last week that basically said President Bush would have nominated Chief Judge Garland to the Supreme Court. Can you tell us why you think so?
Well, I think President Bush, in this situation where the other political party controlled the Senate, I believe that he would have nominated someone like Judge Garland or Judge Garland. We would, of course, have no way of knowing who he would have nominated. But for a number of reasons, I am convinced that President Bush would not have nominated someone who only appealed to a conservative base in the Republican Party when the Democratic Party controlled the Senate. I really say this for two reasons. One, from what I saw quite consistently of President Bush, he was a man who wanted to get the job done. He was a man who would compromise where it was needed to compromise in order to get a job done. He was a man who would insist on doing things the way they needed to be done in situations where it was particularly important. He is not somebody who would have allowed a seat on the Supreme Court to go vacant for a year or more simply because he wanted to appoint someone who appealed only to the conservative wing of the Republican Party. If he had confronted a Democratic Senate, I'm very confident that President Bush would have figured out what he needed to do to put a good justice on the Supreme Court, even if that justice were somewhat different from Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts. He would have found a way to put a good justice on the court, and I believe Merrick Garland would have been the type of person that President Bush would have looked to. Second, I want to say that as chief ethics counsel, I was involved in looking at financial conflicts of interest and potential conflicts that judges had with prior cases they had decided and their financial holdings. Many people on the short list were run by me. I was there during both the appointment, the nomination and confirmation of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. I saw many of those names on the short list. I am not going to discuss what those names are, but I will say that President Bush, even with a Republican Senate, was looking at a range of different candidates for the Supreme Court of the United States. And President Bush is not someone who had a rigid idea of what a type of jurist would be appropriate for the Supreme Court.
You know, you mentioned something in your remarks that maybe both you and Michael can engage, which is the notion that there will be a vacancy on the court for the foreseeable future into the next term. And maybe as former White House counsel, it would be useful for everyone to hear from you what you think the costs of that are.
Well, that's going the vacancy is already going to make it very difficult for the court to decide important cases during this term. And a number of cases, if there are decisions that are made, those decisions are not going to be viewed as binding precedent. You could have some 4-4 decisions. You could have situations where decisions on critical issues are put off to the next term. If the Senate does not act on the president's nomination of Judge Garland, what we are going to experience is the loss of another term of the Supreme Court. We could have the court with 8 justices going into this election, and for the entire next term, a good chunk of next year. This is an unacceptable situation for anybody who believes in an orderly government.
Michael, do you want to add to that question?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that sentiment. I mean, it's having a court functioning with only 8 justices for one term is bad enough. Having the prospect of it for 2 terms really is unacceptable. And I do agree that it would be likely to extend throughout the course of 2 terms if the Senate were not to consider a nominee until after the election, because of course you're not just talking about on election in November, you're talking about a new president, a Congress turning over in January, a new president being sworn in at the end of that month in January, and then you've got to have the nominees submitted and go through the entire process, which, you know, could take, would be expected to take some time. So you really would be looking at almost two full terms of the Supreme Court in which you'd have a vacancy, and that really would not be a situation that I think anyone who cares about the institution of the Supreme Court would want to see.
Well, so that reminds me of another piece of writing that Richard did recently, and that was for the Atheist blog, and the title was "The USA is Not a Banana Republic," and I'm hoping, Richard, you can sort of explain what you meant by that.
Well, we have a constitution in the United States and says that presidents are elected for 4-year terms. And there's certain responsibilities the president has, and one of them is to nominate Supreme Court justices and other judges. Senators are elected for 6-year terms, and they have responsibilities. They provide advice and consent, and they can withhold consent. But there's a process for that, and there are hearings, and there is a vote. We have never not had a hearing for a Supreme Court nominee, never, since the hearings began in 1916 for Justice Brandeis. So this would be the first time ever the Senate has simply refused to hold a hearing for a United States Supreme Court nominee. And this is just not the way an orderly republic does business. We don't just shut down our government because it's an election year. And say, well, let the people decide. The people will decide in November who the next president is and who is in the next Senate. But until January, we have a Senate and we have a president. The president needs to do his job up until his last day in office, and the Senate needs to do its job, and that means holding hearings and having a vote.
And you mentioned the tradition of holding hearings since 1918. Michael, since you were intimately involved with moving the Sotomayor and Kagan nominations forward, maybe could you share with us your views on the importance of public hearings and also why you think this nomination has been treated so differently from the others that you've worked on?
Sure. I mean, you know, the hearings have not existed throughout our constitutional history. I mean, hearings have been consistent since the Wilson administration. What's interesting about the Brandeis nomination that Richard mentioned is that that was the first of two nominations that Wilson made in 1916. He made another nomination over the summer of 1916 in the midst of a presidential election campaign when Justice Hughes resigned from the court in order to run for president as Wilson's opponent. And no one thought at the time that it would be inappropriate for Wilson to nominate and have a justice confirmed to replace him. You know, the number of presidents who have throughout our history made appointments, successful appointments to the Supreme Court in election years is astounding, and it includes not just Wilson and not just Ronald Reagan, but also presidents such as Abraham Lincoln and George Washington, who nominated Justice Ellsworth in 1796. So this is a long history going back. The hearings have become very important as a vetting process for the Senate to perform its advise and consent role. But I would agree with Richard that it would be unprecedented to refuse to hold a hearing in the modern era based on the argument that the president in the final year of his term in office is simply not entitled to nominate someone to the Supreme Court. It would functionally mean that for nominations purposes from this point forward, all presidencies would essentially be 3 years, and in the event of a re-election, you'd have a one-year lull and then another 3 years, but that would be the only years available to appoint and nominate someone to the Supreme Court, and that simply can't be the way our system works if we want to have a well-functioning democratic system with a court that doesn't have vacancies that stretch out over periods of years or longer.
And Mike, from what you know of President Barack Obama's criteria in selecting Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, does the nomination of Chief Judge Garland align with those criteria? Is there something new that we're seeing? What do you think about that?
I think it's perfectly in line. I mean, the president has explained, I think he explained in a post on SCOTUS blog what criteria he would be using for the nominee, and he said he wants someone with unimpeachable qualifications, and certainly Judge Garland meets that. Judge Garland is someone whose qualifications are not in question. I think, you know, Miguel Estrada was on one of the Sunday shows calling him astronomically qualified. People from both sides of the aisle would agree with that, I expect. The second criterion is that the president is looking for somebody who understands the limit of the judicial role, so someone who understands that judges interpret law but not make it, and I think that notwithstanding the various attacks that have been surfacing on Judge Garland, I don't think that you're hearing from many respected quarters the charge that Judge Garland is a judicial activist. It's simply not consistent with the body of work that he has completed as a judge, and I think his record speaks for itself there. And then the third issue that the president has talked about being important is somebody whose life experience suggests that the law is not, you know, merely an intellectual exercise, but somebody who understands how the law actually affects people's lives on a day-to-day basis. And I do think that Judge Garland meets that test as well. He's shown that consistently throughout his career of public service, from his leading role in the Clinton administration and the Oklahoma City bombing prosecutions, where he was lauded not just for the way that he managed the case and managed the federal bureaucracy, but also the attention that he gave to the families of the victims and his understanding of how these proceedings would affect people who had lost loved ones and whose lives had been ripped apart by terrorism, but also to the care that he's shown in his local community, to tutoring and his investments that he's made in public schools, and also the care and attention that he's given to the institution of the court that he's been selected to lead on the D.C. Circuit. So I think all of these, I think all the criteria that the president has laid out are ones that Judge Garland fits very well.
I have more questions for you guys, but I think what I'll do is ask one more and just put our callers on notice that if they have their questions, they should be getting them ready, and our operator will handle those in a minute. But my question is sort of, what's your take on what the current state of affairs means both in the short term with regard to this particular nomination and how you think it'll play out, and the long term and its lasting effect on the nominations and confirmation process? Richard, do you want to start?
Well, I think it's clear what the voters want. The polls I've seen show that an overwhelming majority of the American people want a hearing for Judge Garland. And if the Senate can't proceed to do its job and have a hearing and do that quickly, I think we are going to be dealing with a very upset electorate in the fall. And as a Republican, I'm very worried about that for the Republican Party, because we already have chaos at the top of the ticket and a situation that a lot of conservative voters and moderate Republicans are very unhappy with the choices that they're being presented with. We have a lot of bad behavior. We have people talking about bringing guns to the convention, a lot of things that just are not going to appeal to traditional Republican voters. And you add to that a dysfunctional Senate, and I think there's going to be a disaster in the fall, at least from the perspective of the Republican Party. And I think that's most unfortunate, because we need a government with two well-functioning parties that can run competitive candidates, and we need a Senate that does its job. And I think there's at this point are going to be a lot of alienated voters, a lot of alienated Republican voters, and it's not going to be a good situation in the fall. And we'll just see where things go from there. But I'm very worried about it.
Yeah, and I'd say that, you know, I mean, I agree on the polling point. I mean, the CNN poll that came out recently said 68% of independents, 55% of Republicans believe that the Senate should hold hearings. It's going to be increasingly difficult, I think, for Republicans in the Senate to hold the line on this. You've already seen Senators Kirk, Moran, and Collins state hearings and a vote. Senator Grassley is back in Iowa this week for town hall meetings, and he's up for re-election, and he may be feeling some pressure on agreeing to schedule hearings. So I do think it's very difficult as we go through the spring and into the summer, you know, in particular with a very divided a Republican electorate in terms of who the Republican nominee for president should be. I think it would be very difficult to hold this line. You asked a question about the long-term consequences, and that's really, I think, of great concern. Because if it is the case that that our precedent is that in any election year, the president can't fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court, you've essentially created a situation where you'll have essentially three years of an active presidency for purposes of nomination and confirmation, and that will change the incentives of all the players in this process. It'll change the incentives of justices on the court who may be considering retirement. It'll change the incentives of administrations in the future and future senates, and this, you know, the process of nominating and confirming nominees involves a lot of gamesmanship from the parties in the Senate, and this is a dangerous game that's being played, because it really has the potential to do damage to an important institution of government.
Well, thank you both. Melissa, our operator, can you now engage the call and help us to get questions from our callers?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. We will pause for just a moment for the Q&A roster. And our first question comes from the line of Jim Rowley with Bloomberg News. Jim Rowley, your line is live.
Yes, I wondered if either of you could talk about the jurisprudence of Judge Garland on the court, and whether it provides any evidence that, as does his seemingly his career at Justice, that he could be a consensus builder if he were to be at some point confirmed and become an Associate Justice.
Well, this is Richard. I will just say that he's been on the D.C., the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia for a long time, and has a very distinguished record. And there's, over many years, very little, if anything, that could be considered a red flag for those who are more conservative in their perspective on jurisprudence. He gets along very well with his colleagues, and he is very highly regarded by Republicans and Democrats. And so I think the evidence is very clear on that.
Yeah, and this is Mike. What I would say is, you know, I don't have the precise statistic off the top of my head, but I think it's something like in his term on the court, which is around 19 years, I think Garland has averaged less than a dissent a year. This is not a judge who is known for being somebody who frequently dissents or reaches out to decide issues that aren't squarely presented by the case in dissents or concurrences. That's just not his reputation. His reputation is much more a judge who seeks to find common ground with the judges on the panel or the full court when a case is being heard on bank. So I would think that that a Justice Garland would have the potential to find ways of reaching compromise cases in common ground, seeking common ground rather than seeking out aggressive positions or dissenting views.
If I could follow up with one comment you made, Professor Painter. You said that you don't think there's anything on his record that would be a red flag. There's some people, I think the NRA maybe is already pointing to the fact that he voted to rehear the court's upholding of the Heller decision, which threw out the D.C. gun ban on First Amendment grounds. How would you, if you were advising, or if you were asked how you would vote on that, how would you explain that vote?
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, the Supreme Court not yet decided the issue. And so if you had an opinion that appears inconsistent with what the Supreme Court has said thus far, I would think a rehearing would be in order. That the courts of appeals need to be very careful that not getting out ahead of the Supreme Court, particularly on overturning legislation. And if we're going to talk about judicial activism, I mean, that's become a pet phrase here. But when you overturn gun laws and campaign finance laws and other laws, when courts are doing that, that is judicial activism. Sometimes it is justified under the Constitution, sometimes not. But we've seen judicial activism on the left. We've seen it on the right. And when judges are doing that, they need to be extremely careful. And courts of appeals should never get out ahead of the United States Supreme Court in that respect. And I think that was his concern there. And once the Supreme Court has had its say, and the Supreme Court chooses to strike down certain statutes under the Second Amendment, then it's the obligation of the courts of appeals to follow suit. But the Supreme Court, I don't think the courts of appeals should get him out ahead on that kind of thing. And he did the right thing.
Thank you.
The next question comes from the line of Alan Leeserson, retired attorney.
Thank you. My question is, does the majority leader have sole say on this, or does the chairman of the Judiciary Committee have a role? And either way, do you all have a guess as to how many Republicans would need to come out in favor of a hearing to change that decision on the part of either of those decision makers?
I will say that I believe the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee can convene a hearing with the support of the majority of the members of that committee. I don't believe that the majority leader can prevent him from having a hearing. But as a practical matter, the problem we're dealing with is that the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, has an enormous amount of power. And some of that power is derived from the campaign finance system and the fundraising apparatus that he is very much involved with, that has, by the way, received protection from the Supreme Court in some key cases. He has a lot of influence, and so as a practical matter, he may be able to tell senators who are running for re-election that if they want his support, and that means financial support as well as political support in the upcoming elections, they better do what he says. So the practical reality for the Republicans in the Senate may be somewhat different than what they each have the right to do. As I say, I think this chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, if he wants to have a hearing, he's willing to stand up to the majority leader, can have a hearing. And that's what he should do.
Melissa, are there other questions?
We have another question from Jim Raley with Bloomberg News.
And the other question I had was, there were reports over the weekend that the Judiciary Committee has signaled to the White House, and I believe the White House confirmed this in a statement that I read on, in a news story, that they, that the committee staff would receive and review any questionnaire that, that would be sent by Judge Garland pursuant to the nomination, which is a normal process. Does that suggest to you that Grassley is sort of keeping the procedural options open to changing his mind on this?
I'll take a stab at that one. That's a very important first step, to get that questionnaire filled out. It's a quite detailed questionnaire. That takes time. It takes time to review it. That's very important that that be done, usually weeks before the hearing. So it's helpful that that process is underway. But Senator Grassley then does need to schedule the hearing. That's the next step. And I don't know what he will do. I think a much better indicator of that is the public opinion in the country, and particularly in Iowa, and what voters think, and what Senator Grassley cares about his legacy in the Senate of decades of leadership, about his reelection. Voters want to see the Senate do its job. And that means a hearing, not just the form. And so he's going to have to go to that next step if he's serious about doing his job.
Yeah, and I think, you know, accepting the questionnaire means one of two things. It either means that they're open to the idea, that Senator Grassley is open to the idea of at least possibly holding a hearing, or it means that they would like to appear to be open to the idea of it. And I don't think we can know for sure which of those two interpretations of the statement is correct. It's certainly good news that they've indicated that they would receive the questionnaire. That is a necessary first step. It's an important step to beginning the dialogue between the Senate and the nominee. It allows for an important substantive exchange, and so getting that started, I think, is a good thing. But it just remains to be seen what precisely they'll do with that, and whether, you know, it means that they will have a hearing at the end of the process.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that is star 1. And we have no further questions in queue at this time.
Okay, well, thank you, Melissa. If anyone wants to jump in with the last question while I start to wrap us up, you're welcome to. But I just want to thank both of our speakers for sharing their insights today. And for those of you who are interested in discussing the Garland nomination further, I encourage you to go onto our website, acslaw.org. You can find additional events on this topic near you. And I also hope you will join us at our national convention, which is going to be here in Washington on June 9th through 11th. There will certainly be plenty of conversation on this topic there. And registration is now open, so you can find that again on our website at acslaw.org. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
That concludes this morning's conference call. You may now disconnect.